This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Will the internet come back to haunt you? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The CEO of the internet search engine Google didn't like it when personal information about him was published by a reporter who spent 30 minutes on Google. But Google isn't the only one. Yahoo, Microsoft, MSN, and other search engines know who you talk to, what you talk about, and what you're thinking of buying. One worried privacy advocate says it's practically a printout of what's going on in your brain. On To the Point, how much do they have on you? How long will they keep it? What are the safeguards? On the other side of the issue, why do so many people reveal so much on the internet? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. When the search engine Google was used to expose personal facts about Google's own CEO, privacy on the internet became a big story. On To the Point, how information is available on you without you knowing it? What are the safeguards? Why do other people reveal so much of themselves, and will it come back to haunt them? First, this news update, U.S. withdrawal from Iraq will depend on Iraqi forces being able to establish order and provide for defense. But the ministry responsible for Iraqi security is racked with corruption. Knight Ridder newspapers are reporting that almost its entire $1.3 billion budget has been consumed by phony contracts. Hanna Alam is the bureau chief in Baghdad. Halam, this is an extraordinary story which you got from a confidential audit done by the Iraqis themselves and from other sources as well. What's the bottom line?
The bottom line is that for at least 8 months, as this country was trying to build a defense ministry and stand up a self-sufficient Iraqi force with the help of Americans, both civilian and military, a number of contracts were signed, 89 in this investigation, and of those, there were a lot of red flags, a lot of violations of regular sort of standards of contracting of this magnitude, and it appears that a whole lot of money was lost. The estimates range from $500 million to $1 billion tied up in these contracts with various foreign governments and foreign weapons suppliers.
Out of these 89 contracts, you're reporting that the sole beneficiary in 43 of them was a man whose name doesn't even appear on the contracts.
That's right. I mean, that's one of the red flags that, you know, if people had been watching these contracts and looking at them, maybe they would have raised questions about how this man, who's an intermediary, he's not either from one of these governments involved in the weapons deal, why he was receiving this amount of money in his personal bank account in Baghdad. In his defense, I've talked today with some people who worked with him and know him. You know, they said he was just sort of the end of the line for these deals and that he was a minor player and was sort of just, you know, that he'd been used as basically a shell company. That's the allegations from senior Iraqi officials I spoke with today.
And in some of these cases, I gather, contracts were made for weapons and other kinds of equipment that weren't even needed.
That's right. I mean, the U.S. military officials I spoke with about this story said, why on earth would Iraqis need attack helicopters? Right now they need guns and body armor. So while U.S. funds were not involved in these contracts that are under question now, Americans did have to step in and dip into U.S. funds to equip Iraqis with some of the supplies they needed because their superiors were buying equipment that they couldn't afford to maintain and didn't really need.
And you quote a retired Iraqi general as saying that in some cases there were no real contracts even. They just signed papers and took the money. How did that happen?
As it's been explained to me, these U.S.-appointed Iraqi officials got together and they had millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars at their disposal to arm Iraq's new army. So they contracted not directly with another government or a foreign weapons supplier, as would be the norm in a case like this. They contracted with business associates of theirs, friends of theirs, as has been told to me, and set up these three companies and sort of funneled the money. And according to the audit, the amounts paid to these third-party companies don't match the amounts paid to the foreign governments to buy these weapons.
We're talking with Hanna Alam, who is Baghdad bureau chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, what does this say about the ability of the Ministry of Defense in Iraq to rebuild the army, take over the security of the country, and thus, one assumes, liberate American soldiers?
Well, this has caused a big shakeup in the ministry, and this is, of course, the ministry whose performance is one of the main determinants of when the U.S. can begin withdrawing and relying more on Iraqi forces. So this has removed basically the number two and number three in that ministry, people who were appointed first by U.S. officials as people they could trust to build this ministry. So it's set them back both in terms of equipment, but also in terms of credibility and experience and public perception in their government.
And to what extent does it appear that American officials or coalition officials ought to have been aware of what was going on, presuming they weren't?
Yesterday in statements and in interviews, U.S. embassy officials, who they oversee the 20 or so civilian advisors who work in the defense ministry with these officials, including the ones who are under investigation, and U.S. military officials, they all acknowledged hearing the rumors of corruption, and they said they repeatedly warned senior Iraqi officials that something fishy was going on, but that in the end this was a sovereign Iraqi government and a sovereign ministry's funds.
All right, Hanna Alam, a Baghdad bureau chief for Knight Ridder, thanks so much for being with us. On Reporter's Notebook later, oral histories and tape recordings of September 11th. In a moment, will the Internet come back to haunt you? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. The Internet is often called virtual reality, as if it had nothing to do with the real world. But because it stores vast amounts of information about almost everybody, the Internet can have tangible impact on everyday life. Pam Dixon is executive director of the nonprofit World Privacy Forum. Pam Dixon, welcome to our program.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
We are talking to you and talking about this subject in part because of the furor over the report by CNetNews.com, a well-respected internet trade publication, that the executive director of Google, Eric Schmidt, was worth $1.5 billion, that he made $90 million for selling his Google stock last year, and other personal information about him using Google itself and spending only 30 minutes on it. Now Google won't talk to CNET.com for the next year as a result. What's your take on that incident?
Well, when I first heard about it, my first reaction was that I chuckled, and the laugh quickly died away as I thought about the implications. It's actually quite punitive to an entire news organization for doing something that Google advocates that people do, which is use their products.
So that's all that was done. What does it say, though, about how much information is available, not just on Google, but on other search engines as well?
Well, it's been a continuing problem, actually, for quite some time. Of course, as a nonprofit, we hear from people whose lives search engines are impacting on a daily basis. We've heard from a number of people who cannot find work any longer because their first Google result or first Yahoo result is quite negative and really harms their reputation. There was a woman whose ex-husband posted just vile things about her that she couldn't, refute because they were just hearsay. And things like that can be quite damaging, and it's very, very challenging to get this information down. Once it's there, it can really hurt you.
Is this the fault of the search engines themselves?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's a question worth really looking at. We've had some issues when we've gone to search engines in the past. For example, this year we actually went to Amazon.com and requested that they modify their A9.com search engine, because what was happening is that confidential women's shelters were being displayed by photographs and by address. And within 72 hours, they took those photographs down, and there was no problem in terms of, you know, that specific issue. And they were very responsive. And I think that's appropriate. But not all search engines are that responsive. And what does the person do who's, for example, private, or what they thought were private divorce proceedings and acrimonious proceedings, end up on the Internet? It's much more challenging for that kind of person to go to Google or Yahoo and say, excuse me, could you please take down this public record that's floating around? It's quite challenging for people.
Elaborate a little bit on what you mean when you say that the photos and addresses of the women's shelters were supposed to be private and were used negatively against people. What took place?
Well, what took place is basically we were able to get those down, and A9 worked with us to get those down very rapidly. I mean, they have a Yellow Pages system where they drove by.
Yeah, but before you get there, what was the negative impact of having the pictures and addresses up there?
Oh, well, for example, a confidential women's shelter you don't want to have online so that, you know, the victims are revealed. The particular pictures were taken by cars that were driving by, so people exiting buildings and also cars with their license plates were clearly visible in front of the shelters. So this was a substantial issue to get taken care of.
So it was a violation of privacy and an invitation to somebody who wanted to come and perhaps retaliate against the women mm-hmm. could do it. That's what you're saying.
It was primarily a retaliation problem. I think mm-hmm. that it would be tough, depending on what state you lived in, to bring a lawsuit for a lot of different reasons. But I think on moral ground, it was the right thing to do.
Do you think that there ought to be legal protections of some kind that we don't have now?
Well, we certainly don't have too many legal protections whatsoever. If you have a bad Google result or a bad Yahoo result, and it's keeping you from getting employment, as it has many people, you don't have the right to fix that right now. I think that the very first thing that should happen is that Google and all search engine companies should appoint a chief privacy officer. To our knowledge, Google does not have that, not a person who's absolutely dedicated to that position, and that's all they do. And I think also Google specifically needs to appoint a consumer advocacy board where people who are having these kinds of life problems as a result of their Google searches can get some action and some relief.
If you will, tell us what happened with Google in regard to the women's shelters.
Well, we approached them in April, actually in person at a conference, and asked them to look at this issue because we had received complaints from women's shelters and from also victims whose information was online, and they were very concerned. And we were completely dismissed, and we were told that it wasn't a problem because this was information that came from third parties, and they were therefore not responsible. So we did not get a good response on that particular question.
You said there could be legal problems setting up regulations. Doesn't that have to do with the freedom of speech?
Yes, and also with issues relating to public records. You know, I think my greatest concern about legislation would be not that it isn't needed, but that it would be strong enough. I think that sometimes legislation can be so watered down that you're almost better off without it. However, it's certainly something I think that needs to be debated vigorously, and I would certainly like to have a civil rights of information, if you were. I think all of us really deserve the right to control our information to some degree. I mean, this is an information society, and we don't have any real substantive information rights. What's that about?
I should say, with regard to whether Google has a privacy officer, they say they don't, but they do have a considerable team of lawyers who work on this subject to address privacy issues. They say they're also trying to build in privacy protection options in new products. What other examples can you give us of negative use of the search engines?
Well, I think that the most profound uses, of course, are to stalk people, to harass people, and bully them online. That can be a real problem. There's an interesting new trend where companies are trying to do reputation management online, where they'll search for their name and they'll see all the bad results and try to clean it up. It's a growth industry. So I think that one of the big issues is that if someone says something negative about you, or if there's a negative or unfair posting about you, it can be quite damaging to you and you have no control. There was one situation not too long ago, just a few months ago, where a man had been arrested and his wife had accused him of abusing their child sexually. It was a false charge, but what had happened is that record was put onto law enforcement intranet, not the internet, but kind of their internal system, and they didn't have the proper settings, so Google picked that up, and now whenever you do a search on this man's name, unfortunately, that record comes up, and it was that charge, by the way, was dropped, but it's his first Google result, and he can't get it off.
Okay. Pam Dixon, again, Executive Director of the World Privacy Forum, nonprofit public interest organization. Elizabeth Spires is editor of MediaBistro.com and gossip blogger. She created the site Gawker.com, which is a website published in New York and talks about media news and gossip. Elizabeth Spires, welcome to you.
Good to have you.
What do you have to say in response to what we heard from Pam Dixon, that there are a lot of problems with the Internet? You're one who obviously wants to get the dirt on people.
Well, sort of. I actually disagree with Pam's assertion that the proliferation of Google's power and search engines in general is a negative thing. I think, especially in Google's case, Google is sort of designed to be totally agnostic in terms of what sort of information that it picks up. And you have to keep in mind that everything that it's picking up is already publicly available somewhere else. And so if your issue is that this information is sort of out there in the first place, you're talking about an entirely different problem that's completely exterior to how search engines function. You're talking about a debate about whether or not certain things should be public in the first place. And whether or not publicly available government records, for example, should be public. So I think there are sort of two lines of debate here. But with regard to search engines in particular, I'm not worried at all about the privacy effects of Google.
What about the people about whom false information has been made public and who are unable to correct it in any way, I gather, from what Pam Dixon said, and so it's still out there on the search engines. Nobody can do anything about it.
Well, I've been in that position myself because the blog that was referred to earlier, Gawker, got a lot of press when we started it. And so, I get written about a lot and about a third of it's inaccurate, and a lot of the inaccurate stuff ends up at the very top of the search engine. I don't particularly like it, but I also don't want Google to start trying to find a way to sort of censor certain types of information, because I think the overall negative effects of that are much worse.
Why?
Well, I feel like the marketplace sort of takes care of itself. When people read something, read a Google post, or read a post about me that sort of ends up on Google with a very high ranking, and it's inaccurate, I think consumers are savvy enough now, and increasingly more so, the more people adjust to use of the Internet, that they're going to make their own decisions. You know, if you're going to base your opinion on somebody's career character based entirely on a Google search, that's a level of sort of, I would say, just naivete in and of itself. I don't think that any serious employer is ever going to do that.
Elizabeth Spires, who's editor of Media Bistro and the gossip blogger Gawker.com. Mark Rodenberg, director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, which, as its name implies, advocates privacy. He's also co-author of the book Information Privacy Law. Mark Rodenberg, welcome to you.
Hello.
What can the law do about this without getting into the kinds of censorship problem that Elizabeth Spires just pointed out?
Well, I think we need to just distinguish between two different activities. I actually agree with Elizabeth that we probably don't want Google making judgments about which information to make available to Internet searchers and which information to withhold. That would give them an enormous amount of power over the availability of information. And I think Google taking a hands-off approach on the search function side is the right approach. I think where the privacy concerns begin really have to do more with Google's own internal collection and use of personal information. For example, the search histories. When people type in a search phrase at Google, I think it's important to have some legal protections around that activity, just as the Gmail service, which is also offered by Google, raises some privacy concerns.
We'll talk with Mark Rotenberg. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, what do you mean that with regard to the controls on this? And let me ask you if it is correct to say that Google and the other search engines, when you make a search on them, permanently record the fact that you've done that and where you've gone and where you've been led by the search engine?
Yes, I think they do typically record search histories, and even when they will delete some records, information is also kept in backup and archival records. So it turns out to be very difficult, in fact, to truly delete search histories. And, of course, concerns start to arise when there are civil discovery motions, when warrants arrive from the police, and we really don't know very much about the circumstances under which Google discloses all that personal information it's collecting. So you can think of Google, you know, it's a 21st century media publisher. It has very important First Amendment rights as to its publication activity. But in terms of the information that it collects about people, I think there should be some privacy restrictions and some safeguards to protect against misuse.
So these would be then laws and regulations. Which government agency would impose them, and who would make the decisions about what and under what circumstances things could be disclosed?
Well, I think you could certainly have federal legislation. We have legislation right now that concerns wiretapping, for example, and can also apply to stored electronic communications that could be applied to Google and enforced in the courts. You look at a service like Gmail, which is an interesting service, very popular. Google offers, I think, now 2 gig of storage to anyone who signs up for the Gmail service, and they're getting the advertising, which helps support the service. But Google is also using virtually the same technique that the FBI proposed called Carnivore, which was to target keywords in the communication, and based on the keywords in those messages, to generate advertising. For the FBI, targeting keywords was the basis for pursuing a criminal investigation. And I think, again, this is an area that really requires some oversight and some legal regulation.
Elizabeth Spires, the term carnivore has sort of an interesting connotation in this context. What about the person Pam Dixon referred to earlier, whose false accusation of child abuse was part of a police record that wasn't properly protected, consequently got on the Internet? What do you do about that? Is there any way that guy can get his record off?
Well, in that case, I would say the fault lies with the police department that didn't correct the record in the first place. I don't think Google should be held responsible for that in any way. And you have to consider the same things happen offline. You know, when mistakes are made and a newspaper, for example, falsely reports that someone or words an item in such a way that it seems as if the person in question was guilty and was not. I mean, these things happened well before the Internet.
So Elizabeth Spires. Excuse me for interrupting you. We need to go to a break. We will come back, hear more from Elizabeth Spires and our other guests as well. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, New York is reliving September 11th because of new information and tape recordings released today. We'll hear about those back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about the massive amount of personal information that is on the Internet and made available to people by Google and the other search engines. We all know all the names of those. Earlier, Pam Dixon with the World Privacy Forum mentioned a case where a man who was falsely accused of child abuse couldn't get, or can't, I guess, to this day, get that information off the Internet because of a problem with a police record. Elizabeth Spires indicated she thought that was the fault of the police department, not Google, and pointed out that this happens offline as well as online, and there are things that you can do about that. I want to go back to Mark Rotenberg on that point. What about it? The laws exist. There's libel. There's other kinds of ways of getting at agencies or human beings when other human beings, when these kinds of issues occur. Why aren't those laws good enough?
Well, I think sometimes they can work. I mean, certainly if you can find the source of the defamatory information, that's really where you should direct your energies. There's always the concern online that people are able to publish things anonymously, and this gives rise to the so-called John Doe suits, where the Internet providers are put in the position of trying to identify people who publish harmful information. But it is interesting, of course. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about pushing responsibility to the endpoints, except when it comes to the posting of material that some might consider to infringe copyright, then companies like Google and others, you know, may be held responsible. So whatever standards we establish in the copyright realm, I think we should probably establish in the privacy realm as well.
Pam Dixon, you brought up that case. What do you say to what we just heard from Mark Rotenberg?
I have to agree with Mark wholeheartedly. We really need to have some kind of civil rights for how our information is handled. Right now, it's very challenging to get this information corrected. You're really left up to the whim of the individuals who are aggregating the information or the companies and to the original poster. And it's not true that in every case people have the technical skills to correct some of these mistakes. I mean, this is a very large world, and not everyone has great technical expertise. So I think that we need to rely on fairness that's been encoded into laws.
Back to Elizabeth Spires with Media Bistro and Gossip Blogger, creator of the site Gawker.com. You said earlier that you think users of the Internet are getting pretty savvy about these things and can make judgments and distinctions on their own. Let me change the subject a bit. It's also true that a lot of people are putting out a lot of information about themselves, whether it's on Friendster or some of the other sites. Let me ask you, Elizabeth Spires, why you think they do that, and if the Internet is, in fact, in a way, sort of creating new kinds of relationships with people and new concepts about what's private and what isn't.
Sure. Well, I think part of it's sort of a generational thing. I know I'm kind of on the cusp. I'm 28, and so I'm right smack in between Gen Y and Gen X. And I have reservations about putting personal information online. I mean, I had a personal blog before I started Gawker, but it was really about finance and foreign policy, and I didn't talk about my personal life very much. But I have cousins and, you know, children of friends who are 12 and 13 and 14 who do these very detailed personal blogs, and they talk about their lives very extensively. And I think for, you know, kids that age, they've grown up, they don't remember not having the Internet. And so they assume that the price of using the Internet is that you give up a certain level of privacy. And that's definitely a different attitude than I would say those of us who remember growing up without the Internet and having to adjust to the realities that has imposed on us.
Is that, do you think, going to come back to haunt them when they have things to protect, like their credit rating and their assets and their health records, even their criminal records?
Right. Well, I don't think they're going out and posting their credit ratings and their assets.
No, but might they do that, or might they not realize the risks of posting personal information because, as you say, they've grown up with Friendster and the other kinds of search engines?
I think on a case-by-case basis that's probably true, but they're also, when I talk to, you know, kids that age, they're also a lot more savvy about the dangers of doing it. They're much more realistic about the fact that they're putting this stuff out, and that it's the equivalent of essentially putting your diary on a Times Square bulletin board in a way that I don't think I would have been at that age. So I do think it's one of those things, the market kind of adjusts to whatever's happening, and, you know, the next generation has a better understanding of the implications of the Internet than I do, or, you know, my peers who are older do.
Excuse me, I don't want to sound Internet illiterate here. I referred to Friendster as a search engine. Obviously, it's not. It's a different form of Internet communication. Dana Boyd is a PhD researcher at School of Information Management and Systems at UC Berkeley. She's also a researcher at Yahoo Research Berkeley. She blogs at Zephoria, which is a personal website. And Dana Boyd, thanks to you for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you think about the sociological aspects of what we're talking about?
Well, the thing is that
teens have actually always put themselves out in the public. It's just that the forms in which they can do that have shifted. I mean, when, you know, we were kids before the internet, we put ourselves out in the public sphere. We went to the mall, we dressed up, we conveyed as much information as we could on our clothing and in other forms to let people know who we are as we figured out our own identity. So the same actually holds true online. We're given a larger public forum that we want to express who we are in order to figure that out. These are the years in which we figure out who we are, how we fit into culture, and what really matters to us. And we're looking around for other people like us. The internet allows people to, you know, get exposed to a ton of different kinds of people, but the same goals still exist.
Well, what about the risks?
Well, most people don't think about the risks in the way that we don't think about the risks when we go into the public parks, per se. You think about talking to the people that actually matters. I mean, most people are talking, you know, with a sense of who they're talking to, an audience. It's their group of friends, and they don't understand why anybody else would come by and look at this stuff. It doesn't make sense. It's just like if you were in the park and someone's overhearing your conversation, if it's not relevant to them, why listen? And so that's the general attitude you hear from people, because they're really talking to a group that they know and using the kinds of language that they think is appropriate for that community.
Does the internet and the way it works make them vulnerable then in ways they might not have been before?
Well, it exposes you to a larger population all at once, and it's a situation where you have asynchronicity. So the fact is that your data is now searchable, archived, all of these other things that we don't think about as properties of everyday life. So there is exposure, there is risk, but it's not what's the most important. The most important thing when you're 14, 15, 16 is to find friends, to figure out, you know, how you fit into things. You're not thinking about what you're like when you're 40. These things don't matter. You know, the idea of credit rating, that doesn't make sense. It's not part of the cultural context at youth. And so the tools that they're using are meeting their needs, and they don't really care about the priorities that we as adults have. They think that they're kind of foolish.
Dana Boyd, again, at Yahoo Research Berkeley. Let me go back to Elizabeth Spires. I read somewhere recently somebody saying that in 2016 there's going to be an election, and as a result of youthful indiscretion on the internet, some candidate is going to be nailed for something that he or she might wish they had never said. Do you look forward to that as well?
Actually, you know, I think that will happen to a greater extent than it's happening now, but there are a couple of trends at work there. It's not just sort of the proliferation of people posting information on the internet, but it's also news cycles have sped up a lot because of the internet in part, and people are covering candidates in a way that they weren't able to 15 years ago. I mean, there was sort of, at one point, we were thinking of, I did a sort of piece on Media Bistro about how Watergate would have been different in the internet age. You would have not just had these sort of daily reports about what was happening. You'd have countdown clocks and minute-by-minute descriptions of exactly who was where, and the level of scrutiny is going to be a lot higher. And I can't help but think that that's also a good thing. It makes people a lot more responsible. But I also think the voting public's tolerance for youthful indiscretions and peccadilloes is going to increase in the same way that it kind of has over the last few generations. Things that, you know, a candidate who once used marijuana, for example, would be less scandalous in this day and age than it probably would have been 40 years ago.
Dana Boyd, what do you think about that? Are there different standards, new standards, do you think, forming as a result of the internet?
I totally agree. It's, you know, changing over time with each generation, and it has for every new kinds of media that we've had. And I think that is important because it's, you know, sort of these false ideas that we have that, you know, our elected officials are perfect in these, you know, dreamy ways or whatever, and no one's lives look like that. And what's happening is that people are sort of identifying more and more with the characters that we elect because it makes more sense, you know, the kinds of lives that they lead, that we can find out about, you know, their indiscretions, et cetera. And so when you have a teenager who's, you know, going through puberty online, you know, everybody's going to identify that. We all did it.
So it isn't virtual reality anymore then. It is somehow you're suggesting a more profound sense of reality that we might get as a result of the internet.
Right, because we can identify with people as they sort of change over time. And, I mean, there are generational differences, and that's important to remember. You know, when as adults, especially as parents, we have a tendency towards protectionism that, you know, teens don't have. So there's, you know, there are shifts. We get more protective of our personal data as we get older. So the things that we will see that 16-year-olds do, we're not going to suddenly see the same indiscretions available online with older folks because they are more protective of their private sphere.
Dana Boyd at Yahoo Research Berkeley blogs herself at Zephoria. Back to Mark Rotenberg with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC. Do you think that there may be evolving here new and different senses of what privacy is and ought to be?
Well, I do, Warren. I mean, I have kids, and they have a different sense of privacy from the privacy that I had growing up. But at the same time, they have a sense of privacy. Their email communications, for example, or what they IM to their friends, they understand as something that they're sharing with others who they've selected to say certain things to. And I think it's very interesting in a way that as new technologies are introduced, you know, our grandparents who got the telephone when their parents had the postal mail developed their own sense of privacy with the new technology. I think that will happen as well with the Internet. We have a radical sense today of what it means to make something public because it's not just a few people around you who will hear something. It could be the whole world. But I don't think that means that we lose our sense of what is private. It may simply mean that we redefine it over time.
So people learned by the telephone not to reveal personal secrets on the party line because you never knew who would be listening in. The same kind of thing you think will happen with the Internet?
Right. And, of course, the history of the telephone is interesting as well. It began very open because people were sharing the same line and they were careful about what they said, you know, with their neighbors listening and other people in a building and so forth. But over time, the telephone became something in a home, and today it's actually associated with a single person. This is something also that I think people have missed in the transformation of our technology. We've actually, as technology has evolved, gone from a recent period where a telephone line was for all the members of a house and anyone might pick up a phone and listen to what others were saying, to a period today where people have telephones that are unique to them. So I think it can be a mistake to assume that simply because technology makes possible the rapid dissemination of information, people won't still desire greater privacy.
Elizabeth Spires, Media Bistro, gossip blogger. What do you say to that?
No, I sort of agree with that. I think that people are not going to change their notions of what privacy means. Even, you know, younger kids who do have a slightly different notion are also compensating in other ways. I mean, some of the information that they're putting on the Internet is just not necessarily true. There's also a level of sort of skepticism, and they tend to use the Internet to sort of test out different personalities that they may not have. And so there's also a sense that, you know, a lot of what you're seeing is not necessarily trustworthy information. So the value or the potential for it to be abused is kind of a moot point in some cases.
Pam Dixon, our first guest, Executive Director of the World Privacy Forum, you were concerned about the abuses of the Internet. What about the possibility that it will evolve into a tool that everybody understands very well, its limitations and risks and vulnerabilities as well as its benefits? And do you think these concerns will go away in the future?
I think we're definitely in a transitional era. I don't think we can look at what's happening now either from a social perspective or even from a technology perspective and say this is the way it's going to be for 20 years. I think we'll continue to see rapid change in this area that we're talking about. And I have to kind of go back to what Mark was saying about the way the phone changed. And I think there's a very interesting parallel with the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which is a law that really controls how background checks are done. You know, that's when you do a background check on a person for employment purposes or for some other purposes, you're really looking at what used to be a large body of information that was, you know, public records and some private records. And, you know, that was legislated and controlled. And I think at this point, you know, while we have a wide open frontier, we do have quite a lot of evidence that employers, for example, are Googling people and using other engines such as Friendster and others and you know, Technorati, a blog search engine, to look up what's happening with employees or potential candidates. And there's no protections there. I don't necessarily think that that's going to stay the same. And socially, I'm not sure how that will change. I'm not sure that teenagers will continue in the current trends that we're seeing now.
Dana Boyd, back to you, Yahoo Research, Berkeley. There are people who put naked pictures of themselves on the Internet and are revealing about themselves in other ways as well. Should the standard be user beware, or what do you think about the engines themselves, for example, establishing some sort of limit?
I think user beware is always a good thing because it's beware within the cultural context. And, you know, I want to actually point out that, you know, with the phone, yes, we had an idea of privacy, but we still had teenagers using three-way calling to try to let somebody in on a conversation that was happening. So there's a user beware, and then there's these moments where we have to have a social contract about what we're responsible to with other people. And that's where we get into a danger point with the engines, because a lot of the concern is not what you put up online, but what somebody else put up online for you. And the idea that it's breaking certain social norms as well as legal norms when it comes to institutions putting up data. And so there's a real tension right now between whether or not the engines are responsible or whether or not the, you know, there's a contract that was broken by a person or by an institution who put that material up. And I don't think that that's a resolved issue at all.
All right. This will be something all of us will be talking about for a long time to come. We'll certainly come back to it on To the Point. Meantime, thanks to all of you for being with us today. Dana Boyd at UC Berkeley and Yahoo Research Berkeley. Mark Rotenberg with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Elizabeth Spires, Media Bistro and Gossip Blogger, also Gawker.com. And Pam Dixon, Executive Director of the World Privacy Forum. Good to have all of you with us, and thanks again for being here today. The New York City Fire Department has released a massive amount of written and tape-recorded information today revealing what happened on September 11th, 2001. The city is recalling the human struggles that took place against fire and confusion and horror. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manali, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In the awful confusion after the planes struck the World Trade Center on September 11th, what were emergency workers and others saying to each other? What can be learned now from what they said then and what they remember about what happened? Those questions might be answered in oral histories and tape recordings released today because of a Freedom of Information lawsuit brought by the New York Times. John Keefe is news director at WNYC in New York City. And John, thanks a lot for being with us.
Happy to be here.
You've got 21 CDs to listen to, 12,000 pages of documents. What have you been able to cull out of all that so far?
Well, it's been a daunting task, and we have a whole newsroom of reporters with headphones on listening to these tapes right now and going over those documents. We're about 3 hours into the project, and we're starting to pull out some of what we've been able to collect includes some of the initial calls to the dispatchers. To be clear, these are communications between the firefighters and the dispatchers. We're not hearing the 911 calls. Those were not released. So we're hearing a lot of drama and trying to find out what we can learn, what the public can learn from this.
What have you heard so far? What can we hear right now?
Well, I can walk you through a little bit. I personally have been listening to one or two of the CDs, and I can tell you a little bit of what I've heard and play some for you. The first thing I can tell you is that just hearing that first call, there was a battalion chief who was just a couple blocks north of the towers and saw the plane go into the towers, and he was, I believe he's the first person to call this in. This was Chief Joseph Pfeiffer, who did survive the attacks and the collapse later, too. This was his call at 8:46 that morning.
So that takes you right back to the very beginning. A chief, high-ranking official of the fire department actually observed it happen.
He did indeed. And not only that, but he, with some sort of very calm, collected way, was able to even determine that he thought it was a terrorist attack. He suggested that even in the first couple of minutes, and he describes that here.
We have a number of floors on fire. It looked like the plane was aiming towards the building. Transmit a third alarm. We have the staging area at Vessing and West Street.
You can hear all that shouting in the background. He's used the phrase that looked like the plane was aiming toward the building.
Correct, correct. And moments later, he gets there, others get there, and he sends out what's called the 1060, which is a major, huge emergency, and really raises the alarm even higher. Here you go.
Everything you've got. Get to the World Trade Center now.
That's right. He later asks again for every ambulance in the city, anybody who's available, send them. We're in addition to hearing some of the drama, which I must say, for the folks of us who were there or who were near there, who were in New York City, the reporters who went there, they're listening to a lot of this, sort of reliving it in the newsroom. And I'll walk by somebody and they'll be like, oh my goodness, I myself... listened to somebody who had been trapped in one of the fire trucks. It was a civilian who, as the tower was collapsing, climbed into a truck and called on the radio for help. It's really dramatic. It's really hard to keep listening to all of this, and we're actually making some careful decisions about what we air and what we don't, because it's pretty intense. For most part, though, you hear people doing their best, doing their whatever they could to be professional, to try to save people, to respond.
You say that you're being very careful about what to air and what not to. It was some of the survivors of the firefighters, was it not, the firefighters who were killed, and others who died as well, who were part of the suit, who wanted to get this information released.
That is correct. There has been a push, a lot of what we know from... even the push to have the 9/11 commission, now to get these tapes released. A lot of what we know is because victims' families and in some cases media organizations have really pushed to have this stuff released so they can find out basically what happened and what happened to their loved ones and what the government, what agencies, what everybody knew before, during, and after.
Well, certainly one thing you'd want to know is when you heard that chief very dramatically observing the plane flying into the building and saying he thought that it was done intentionally, he then sent out the 1060, getting everybody down there as fast as possible. How quickly was that information distributed to everybody else in the fire department?
We're still working to figure that out. From the sound of it, from what I've heard and what some of the people have heard in the early listening, again, we're only 3 hours into what is really 16 hours of audio that has been released today. It sounds like things were transmitted very quickly. Some of the other details we're trying to look into and see if those issues were transmitted was any sense that somebody should that the fire department should evacuate to get out of the buildings. There is some confusion over that, when that came through, if it ever came through. Some of the oral histories we're already looking at have people saying they never, ever heard an evacuation order. I haven't, and what I've heard so far and what my colleagues have listened to so far, we have not heard that yet. We're also looking into some confusion about which one is Tower 1, which one is Tower 2, and the north one or the south one. There was some confusion even at that basic level. So we're going in trying to think about what sort of the communication was going on and what we might be able to reveal in that.
Talking with John Keefe, the news director at WNYC in New York. When you talk about the evacuation order and when and whether, more importantly, everybody heard that, what is the significance of that? What question arises about it?
Well, the issue is, especially once the South Tower collapsed at just before 10 o'clock that morning, there's pretty clear evidence that the people who were in the other tower had no clue. The rescuers, especially, who are climbing stairways inside the towers, they couldn't see it. They may have felt a rumble. So we're looking in to see to what level are these kinds of major communications able to get into the building. And, of course, there was a lot of issues surrounding it, whether or not the internal communications in the buildings themselves were disabled, lots of other issues like that. And as a matter of fact, I can play for you a little bit more. We actually have what we think is also one of the first calls into the fire department from a boat, a fire department boat that was that had responded to the World Trade Center and was out in the water and saw the collapse of the South Tower. And here's that tape right here.
Identify.
I made the collapse in one of the towers.
Tower,
Kate. Tower 2, Tower 2.
The South Tower made the collapse.
One of the things that comes out of this, I think, is just the calm of the dispatchers. These dispatchers are sitting in Central Park, and they're trying to mobilize an entire city's rescue effort down to the World Trade Center. And if we have another second, I can play a little bit more of how they were trying to keep people calm.
That's about all we've got. Quickly, okay, if you will.
George, have them mobilize the army. We need the army in Manhattan.
All units, stand by. Everybody try to calm down. Manhattan's a field, calm, Kate.
And again, just trying to keep people calm, and poignant point there, he was trying to then reach FieldCom. FieldCom had been covered by the debris of the South Tower.
Extraordinary to hear all this. And, of course, the questions of whether lives could have been saved, whether firefighters stayed in the buildings because they heroically wanted to rescue people or because they didn't know what the emergency was, those kinds of questions will be raised and hopefully answered, too. John Keefe, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
News director at WNYC in New York. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Christian Bordahl, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sherman Rembaugh. Managing producer Cameron Radziner. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.